You are listening to 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. Stay tuned for the Heartland Labor Forum, radio that talks back to the boss. Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum, a weekly show of news, information, and commentary by and for the working people of Kansas City. This show is produced by a team of volunteers from a broad range of workplaces and unions. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI or any unions involved. Tonight's show is being underwritten by Boilermakers Local 83 and Boyd Kenter Thomas & Parrish LLC. This show is sponsored by Proud Union Boilermakers Local 83 from Kansas City, Missouri, the Kansas City, Missouri office, and Iowa, Nebraska, and Kansas. And since 1983, our attorneys have aggressively represented the injured and have provided counseling to labor organizations throughout the area. We stand up for working families against those who would do harm, and that's Boyd, Kenter, Thomas, and Parrish. And the Heartland Labor Forum and KKFI thank our underwriters for their support. On tonight's show, Buster Brown, alias UPS, and the International Brotherhood of Teamsters have a tentative agreement on the biggest contract since the 97 strike. Will they end two-tier? Will they convert more part-timers into full-time? Will they start delivery on Sundays? And then, after you find out all that, what was a Harvey girl? Being one changed the lives of countless working women in America. Learn some local history from Professor Micheline Chance Ray. In the news, AFL-CIO Secretary Treasurer Liz Schuler ignites the crowd at the No on Prop A rally. And who is contributing to the Prop A campaign? You might be amused by the answers. Our feature at the end of the show is Remember Our Struggle with Arianna Eckel. She'll give us a quick history of the Pullman strike. And now for the news.
This is the news from our side, July 12, 2018. On Tuesday, labor unions had a big rally to oppose Proposition A on the August 7th ballot. Hundreds of union members wearing neon yellow and green t-shirts with a No on Prop A message came to the Pipefitters Hall for a rally and then to go out canvassing in the 100-degree heat. They were dedicated. Guest of honor and keynote speaker was Liz Schuler, Secretary Treasurer of the National AFL-CIO. She talked about the stakes for Missouri and the nation in defeating right to work.
Here today, because we got a heck of a fight on our hands, don't we?
Yep.
And we see Prop A as the latest in a string of attacks on the labor movement because the entire country is watching. And I know that you all have been in this fight for years, right? It's been over a decade that you've been waging this battle. And so I really, the first reason I wanted to be here is just to look you in the eyeballs and say thank you, to know that DC is watching you and has your back in this fight. And we are so grateful and appreciative of all the work you've been doing. You're tireless, and you're really showing us what dedicated and committed trade unionism looks like. So give yourselves a hand.
Schuler was then followed by Pat Duke Dujakovich, president of the Greater Kansas City AFL-CIO, and he was upbeat.
People who are the architects of these plans, and let me tell you what at least some of them were thinking when they started this. So what they thought is, look, the way to beat labor is to get them fighting amongst themselves. Let's start a war. And so the idea was, they'll come out with right to work. They'll come out with paycheck attacks. They'll get us fighting about what's more important. Then prevailing wage will come in. They'll start this war. And that was the idea. And so they took the first shot at us. And we fought back. And they said, don't worry, they'll never get 100,000 signatures. We got 300. Over 300. The deadline. They'll never get them in time on the deadline. We did it. They don't have enough notaries to be able to notarize all the signatures. You guys remember notary classes here? Yeah. We had 150 notaries were minted in that period of time. Remember they said, look, you got to do it in 6 congressional districts. Don't waste your time in the other 2. Yeah. We wasted our time. We got them in all 8. Never been done before. We know how to do this, and we know how to do this right. But what I want you to remember is, all of that doesn't count. It is not a win until it's a win on election night. Yep. And so we need to cross that finish line. We need to go out there and to prove to everyone, you started a war, and you're the damn enemy, and we're coming after you. So go vote, please.
Meanwhile, Proposition A supporters have opened an office in Liberty, and they turn out to be none other than the Koch-funded Americans for Prosperity. The only filing of campaign contributions with the state comes from the Freedom to Work Committee, whose address is in Excelsior Springs. As of April 30th, the last report date available, the committee had $1.2 million on hand. In that report, $1.7 million was donated. And it all came from only 5 donors, the largest of which was A New Missouri, which is former Governor Eric Greitens' famous dark money fund, and it gave 2/3 of the total. We Are Missouri, the unified labor organization fighting right to work, filed a 64-page report on contributions and expenditures as of April 30th. They raised far more than the pro-Prop A side, over $5 million. The report was so long because there were hundreds of small contributions.
Thousands of retirees fighting to preserve their pensions rallied today on the grounds of the Ohio Statehouse. Family members and supporters, some who will travel from as far as Alabama and Utah, will join them. Coal miners, truck drivers, bakery workers, and other pensioners could lose their promised retirement income if the Joint Select Committee on the Solvency of Multi-Employer Pension Plans fails to come up with a fix to preserve their pension plans. Failure by Congress to act will cause the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation, PBGC, to collapse, meaning that millions of Americans who already receive their federally insured pensions through the PBGC could see their pensions slashed by as much as 90%. On Friday, the Joint Select Committee will hold its only scheduled field hearing in the Ohio Statehouse. The committee is charged with coming up with a plan by the end of November to end the multi-employer pension crisis. While the committee meets inside, the crowd will gather outside the Statehouse to hear testimony from retirees who depend on their pensions to survive. At today's rally, presidents of the United Mine Workers, the Teamsters, the Bakery, Confectionery, Tobacco, and Grain Millers, the Association of Flight Attendants, and CWA unions, and the president of the Ohio AFL-CIO. The Senate committee is co-chaired by Senators Sherrod Brown, an Ohio Democrat, and Orrin Hatch, a Utah Republican.
The news from our side was read by Jen Zaman and Ariana Heckel.
If you don't consider giving us more concessions, eroding good full-time jobs, stealing the future away, we'll replace you. Someone has to tell these corporations in this country, enough is enough.
It's the MIBs. They call them MIBs.
There go the men in brown.
UPS men dressed in brown all over town. Come to your door, face to face, lay the package down. Deliver to you and me, MIB. Uglier clothes you will not see. You don't see them now, cause they're all gone. Walking picket lines, cause the strike is on. They're peaceful, won't resort to violence. But they won't do their jobs and sit back in silence. MIB feels this, they're in our country, they are sorely missed. If you're delivering packages, watch your back. Cause you never quite know where the MIBs is at.
There go the men.
Day.
Good evening, and welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum. My name is Michael Savoie. I'm your host tonight, and our program is UPS, What Will Brown Do to You? Of course, my guest is Ross Thompson, UPS driver, Lenexa, Kansas, and I don't think there's anybody, Ross, that knows better than you do. How are you this evening?
I'm doing very well, Michael. Thanks for having me on, and I'm happy to be here to chat with you.
Okey-doke. Well, I'm certainly glad you're here because you, better than anyone else, can tell us what a generous company like United Parcel Service has planned for its for its employees, considering that it's been a banner year, that is, they've made $6 billion profits last year. And, of course, we've had the big tax break, you know, the Donald Trump tax break that just gave corporate America a big, big blessing. So, certainly, UPS is going to pass those benefits along to its members, are they not?
Oh, yeah, you know that's going to happen right off the top there.
Well, one would think a benevolent company would take care of its employees, huh?
Well, you would like to think that that's how the operation works, Michael, but unfortunately I'm not gonna hold my breath on that.
Well, I might make a little disclosure to our listening audience there that I too am a retired UPS employee, so I know perhaps as well as Ross does that this benevolent talk I'm making is just a joke. But tell us, Ross, what are the major concerns of active UPS employees with this upcoming contract year, which incidentally expires the 31st of July?
Well, Michael, we've got quite a few issues, actually, that are going on here. As far as UPS wanting to implement the 22-4 hybrid drivers that they're talking about bringing in here to relieve excessive overtime for the regular package car drivers and pay them basically $6 an hour on the average less. That's one of them.
So for our listeners who don't know, Ross, mm-hmm. tell us the 22-4 is a new classification.
A new classification that has been brought in with this contract to bring drivers in. This is technically supposed to relieve drivers that are full-time package car drivers that roughly are making close to $36 an hour. They're wanting to bring these drivers in, and by the time they make top scale, which would take 4 years, they would end up being, well, $6 less an hour.
Okay, so essentially a two-tier full-time wage. Right.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And the issue with that is, Michael, that once that happens, what we're afraid of, UPS has already implemented a Saturday delivery that's going on. So down the line, we can all see with what's going on with Amazon that Sunday will become a delivery day for UPS. And so what we're concerned about as far as regular package drivers that have gained their seniority as of before this contract, that if you bring these drivers in, these 22-4 drivers in, that what they'll do is push as much volume in on Saturday and Sunday, and push as much volume so Monday and Tuesday, what would end up excessively happening is you would have less volume on Monday and Tuesday, and therefore, even through the rest of the week, the overtime that we make could be pushed onto these 22-4 drivers, these hybrid drivers, and allow them to absorb what overtime that we are taking right now, to where we would basically could be 8 hours.
Yeah. Well, you know, Ross, I've been watching labor issues for 50 years, man. There is not a single incident in the annals of labor history where when you when you're paying people two separate wages, why, you're encouraging that division to find its lowest common denominator, not its highest. So invariably, it may not be overnight, but it'll just be a matter of time before the protected group of drivers are actually having the same challenges as the lower paid people are. So that's one big issue. And, you know, I've read a little bit of the tentative agreement. It seems like it eliminates the 8-hour guarantee. In other words, the language reads something to the effect, if work is available, where prior we came to work, buddy, we were guaranteed 8 hours, even if they had to go out and make the work, you know. They paid us 8.
Correct.
So the language in this particular agreement is going to change that. It's saying if work is available, and as you pointed out, that work will not be available for regular drivers if, in fact, you've worked all weekend and you've diminished the availability of work to that lower group or lower paid group of people, then it will also eliminate the possibility of you even getting the 8-hour guarantee on Monday. But go ahead with the other issues you're concerned with.
Oh, well, obviously, with harassment, that's one of the top tiers. With what I've read on this and what I've skimmed over, that there is an additional that they will pay a financial penalty if you win a harassment grievance. But,
our listeners that don't know, when you say harassment, of course, you and I know what we're talking about. But for our listeners that don't have a clue, man, can you kind of describe the harassment that goes on at UPS? It's a consistent production harassment. In other words, if you did 150 today, you expected to do 151 tomorrow, and that goes on in infinitum. So pretty soon you're doing 900 stops a day, man.
Unfortunately, Mike, that's how it goes. And it basically, you cannot work hard enough for it. What every driver, I couldn't even tell you. I would say even if you could even find what you would call a lazy UPS driver, I would say that he is still the hardest working person that I've ever really probably known at being in a company. Mm-hmm. But as far as UPS, that's exactly how they go. Mm-hmm. I mean, the more work we can put on you, and if you get it done, you're going to have more the next day.
Mm-hmm.
It dismantles your family lifestyle. It demands you to be on your toes all the time. No accidents, no injuries. If it is, then it's your fault. They always have an excuse to why to blame the driver or the employee itself.
Mm-hmm.
It's just never ending. The harassment just continues on and
now,
on.
There's been resistance, is there not, to the excessive overtime. There was a provision when I left for a 9-5, that is a 9.5-hour day. So if a guy requested it, seems like they had to honor your 9-5 request. How is that working out? Now, I know that's been a big issue.
Well, that kind of goes, kind of hand-in-hand with the harassment. So me being a driver, if I request, or any other driver at UPS that's a full-time package car driver, request to get on that 9-5 list, just for the being of, being able to spend time with your family or to make your kids' soccer games. I'm a little older now, but I missed out on those before any of this came along. I mean, this 9-5 language, it allows you to be able to get on a 9-5 list, but at the same time, you're also putting a target on yourself.
Okay, so that means you can have a 9.5-hour day every day?
That would be nice if that was the case. Mm-hmm. But you put yourself on a 9-5 list where you don't want to work over 9.5 hours. What will happen is we might pull the company saying we might pull you down on these 2 days or 3 days, because technically under the language you are not allowed to be able to work the driver over 9.5 hours 3 days out of 5-day week. work week, Monday through Friday. You're dispatched, but you have to be under that 9-5 for 3 days.
At least three of the five.
At least 3 days, correct. So, back to what I was getting at was, once you sign on to this list, then basically, and what I hear from other drivers, the junior drivers, they're more scared to get onto this list because of the harassment that will follow. Because what will happen is that the company tends to dispatch you accordingly, but those 2 days that you're going to be, that is basically a gimme for the company, we're going to abuse you and work you probably 12 hours those days.
You're going to pay for it, in other words.
And you're going to pay for it,
okay,
yeah.
Okay, yeah,
and,
that's what I'm hearing.
And not just pay for it by working 12 hours. You might also have a supervisor or two out there following you around.
Okay, so a little bit of harassment, then, as we talked about a little earlier.
Sure.
Yeah,
exactly.
Vicious circle.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us, our listeners, about some of the part-time issues. I know I was amazed recently. I was at a downtown workplace, and how many of our young people that are coming to work as UPS employees, of course, are catching the bus or walking, riding bikes even, because the, 10 bucks an hour starting pay with a 3-hour guarantee just don't, guarantee you can even get a good bicycle, man.
Oh, sure. Michael, when I started there, it was $8.50, and that was a long time ago, mid-'80s.
Yeah. starting wage now is around 10, I believe, is it?
Right, exactly. Uh-huh. So you're talking about basically 30 years. We've got the part-timers up $2.
Yeah.
You know, maybe not even $2 in certain states. It hadn't even made it that far.
And this, of course, is a company that has record profits every year.
Record profits, and they abuse their part-timers no differently than they do the full-timers.
Uh-huh.
I mean,
pretty high turnover rates, huh?
Oh, absolutely. They just can't keep them on, and they don't discriminate. I mean, it doesn't matter. If you're a part-time, full-timer, we're still going to we're still going to harass you, and we're not going to get the work that we want to have out of you, even though you're there, whether you're freeload coming in at 3 o'clock in the morning or you're coming in at 11 o'clock working a night shift. We're still going to tell you basically every day that you're not doing the job that you're supposed to do.
Not good enough. So,
for $10 an hour, you should be doing more work.
Yeah. So for 10 bucks an hour, then you're kind of expected. I can remember, of course, it's been a few years, and I imagine it could be worse now since I was actually in that starting range. But you were expected to unload a 40-foot trailer in an hour, so that means some 1,500 packages in to handle in 1 hour for 10 bucks an hour, man. That's, well, I don't know. It's not slavery. You're getting paid, but my God, that's...
when they back those trailers up, and especially the way it's been this year, as far as the heat and stuff, that doesn't fly with UPS. We don't care if that trailer's been sitting there with that door shut, and we're opening it up, and it's 130 degrees in there. You better get in that trailer, and technology-wise, they want you to hit that number. They want to see those packages coming out, and, right now they can't even, Michael, keep our part-timers staffed, so they pay them an additional $125 if they show up Monday through Friday on time, and they show up every day. So basically, you take that $10 an hour that they're making, they get an additional $125 a week for a show-up pay out there in Lenexa, and I'm probably pretty sure it's going on downtown at James Street.
Yeah, well, I can remember, Ross, before I retired, man, they were bussing people in because it exhausted the local workforce and turnover was so high. So I would imagine this new contract then, negotiated by the International Brotherhood of Teamsters, will address a lot of these real concerns for part-time people.
Well, it doesn't sound like, from what I've read, Michael, is that to doing that much, because as I was talking about earlier with the $125 bonus that these guys get for showing up, even with the $13 starting rate that is in this handshake agreement, they're talking about taking away that bonus that is in existence. So basically, at $13 an hour, these part-timers are still, by the end of it, would be only making $2 less an hour.
Okay, so I'm hearing you say that the proposed increase for part-time starters is $13 an hour.
$13. That's my understanding, too. So by the time, like I said, at $10 an hour, with $125 bonus just for showing up for work, what they got right now, which would disappear once this agreement would take place, and you'd go to $13 an hour, well, you're still making $2 less an hour. So basically, you know, the $15 is what we were promised, that we thought we were promised, because nationwide, that's pretty much it.
Yeah,
that's been pretty much the standard that folks are
organizing around in the fast food industry, for instance, is the $15 minimum. So
exactly.
Then UPS would be, what I'm hearing you say, essentially less than the minimum start pay.
Of a lot of cities.
Yeah, a lot of cities. Interesting, uh-huh. Okay, well, you know, we... certainly, it seems like a golden opportunity to up the ante. As I said, the big tax break this year and the record-breaking profits here that this company has enjoyed. What's the solution here, Ross?
Well, Michael, I wish I had that answer for you right off the top of my head. But, as myself, being a driver and over 30 years at this company, I'm hoping that we can stand shoulder to shoulder and tell this company, as well as the Teamsters that have agreed with this handshake deal, that, you know, this isn't good enough. This is not enough for the future. We have people that are climbing this ladder, and basically the way that I look at it is they're almost asking us to basically slice the throats of the ones that are on the first and second step of a 30-step ladder.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're wanting us to jump on the bandwagon for a couple bucks here and a couple bucks there, but you cannot have a two-tier drivers that you cannot have somebody next to you that's making less than you doing the exact same job. It never works out. I think the UAW tried that, and that didn't work for them.
Well, yeah, a lot of them have tried, but it always seems that they end up making the lowest common denominator.
Unfortunately, it just is a division is what it does. It divides the employees, which is exactly what UPS wants to do. So,
Well, it sounds like this company has a unique opportunity to improve conditions for its workforce.
Sure.
And certainly the timing is right in that profits are at all-time high, and certainly taxes are at all-time low. So let's hope some meaningful resolution can be found. Ross, we've kind of come to the end of our 20-minute period here, man. So I certainly appreciate your input in giving our listeners some insight as to what's going on at UPS and with the UPS contract agreement, which again is expiring on the 31st of July. So appreciate your input, my friend, and we'll be keeping our fingers crossed for a better idea and a more equitable, perhaps, workplace. You know, someone once said content cows give more milk, and I would imagine that content employees do a better job. So perhaps we should voice that in our
negotiate. I can't agree with you more, Michael. I hope that that's exactly the way it goes, and I'm keeping my fingers crossed just as well as you are, too, that that is the outcome. Of
All right, buddy. Well, thank you, and good night to you, my friend.
You bet, partner. Okay.
A heat advisory remains in effect until Friday at 8 p.m. Take extreme care to be cautious and remain hydrated. Check in on the elderly, and avoid strenuous activity when necessary. This message, a public service announcement of 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.
This week on The Bioneers.
We urgently need safe forms for men and women together to tell the untold stories. Why? Because untold stories keeps oppression invisible.
Reverend Cynthia Bricks tells us how her organization creates a path toward healing the gender divide by confronting the structure of patriarchy on Bioneers Radio.
Friday morning at 9:30.
I want to marry you something like all get out. I want to marry you something awful, ma'am, but please, ma'am, please say no.
Miss Bradley, we hardly know each other, so let's keep it that way, shall we? Just a minute. Don't you think you should stick to your dishwashing? Look, we're minding our own business, so suppose you stick to your profession.
Our profession is entertainment, see?
And we don't like competition.
Well, we're amateurs. Don't tell me you're afraid of us.
Afraid of you? Shall we let her have
it? Go on, go on.
Of course, that was the theatrical trailer for The Harvey Girls with the incomparable Judy Garland. This is Jacob White. You're listening to Heartland Labor Forum. Today we have a special guest, Dr. Ray. She is from K-State University, an emeritus professor. And coming up this summer, mark your calendars, July 29th at 2 p.m., she will be at the Central Library, downtown Kansas City, to give a presentation about the Harvey Girls Multicultural Workforce. And, when we heard about that over at Heartland Labor Forum, our ears pricked up because we like to talk about labor history, and we like to talk about local Kansas City history. And I think as you hear Dr. Ray today, you'll find out a little bit more about all of those things. So, Dr. Ray, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, you're welcome. We're going to talk about one of my favorite subjects.
I read somewhere online that you've given like almost more than 70 presentations about them. Is that true? Do you ever get tired of it?
Oh, never, because there are lots of stories to tell, and people have great questions when they come, and stories to tell about people they knew who were Harvey girls.
People have a lot of different ways that they get into history, whether it's because, you know, maybe they had a grandma or a grandpa who worked in a special place and they got interested in that. And a lot of people are interested in genealogy and things of that nature. And I was wondering, what attracted you, what drew you to the story of the Harvey girls, and what inspires you to keep telling their stories?
Well, I hiked the Grand Canyon. I probably went every year for 20 years. And one year I even hiked rim to rim in a day.
Wow.
And when I was there, they have a Harvey girl display about the Harvey girls that worked at the Grand Canyon. And that really started my interest.
Wow. So tell us a little more, because I think it's every 100 miles there was a Harvey's restaurant, or was the name of the restaurant wasn't the Harvey Girls, was it?
No, they had all different names.
Okay. So there were...
About the 100 miles, I don't know. That's probably part of railroad history, though. I'm sure you could Google that.
Yeah. And the stories, you really like the stories. Are there any stories that really stick out to you? Maybe about something in the Kansas City or the Kansas area with the Harvey girls, and you know, just a little bit about how this job changed their lives.
Well, believe it or not, when Fred Harvey opened his first restaurant in Topeka, he had male waiters rather than waitresses, and the Harvey girls didn't get involved until later, in that it wasn't really a proper job for a woman to be a waitress, because she would meet all kinds of people, and if you were a mother or a dad, you probably wouldn't want to expose your daughter to that. But because Harvey had such rules about where they lived, how they lived, what they could do in their off time and their on time, it was a safe job for women. So really, the only connection with Kansas is that he had his first restaurant in Topeka, but there weren't any Harvey girls there.
So the parents, it was like...
Minorities. The most interesting one, I think, I knew they were Hispanic Harvey girls, and girls from Europe, from Russia, from Poland, Czechoslovakia. So a lot of them didn't even speak English, but Fred didn't mind that. I mean, he knew they would learn that on the job. So he would hire women who were from various countries. But I never heard of a Native American being a Harvey girl. And I had a guest at one of the talks who said, my mother-in-law was a Harvey girl, and she's a Navajo. So I went to Albuquerque to interview her, and it turned out her aunt was a Harvey girl, and her aunt would take her to Death Valley in the summertime during World War II, and she would help there. And she used the money that she made to go to school. She had five sons, and they sent all of them to college. So I thought that was pretty neat. But I've never found an Asian Harvey girl, so that's on the list. If anyone knows an Asian woman who was a Harvey girl, I'd like to know about that.
That's interesting to me, because I know from we've done quite a few stories actually about labor in the American West, and you know, you can find Chinese workers and immigrants from other parts of East Asia kind of all over, and the Harvey girls was a Western phenomenon, wasn't it? I mean, you've mentioned Arizona a couple times. Where are some other places that you've found some stories about Harvey girls?
Well, all the way from Cleveland to Chicago to, or let's say Cleveland to St. Louis to Chicago to San Francisco, and then down through Oklahoma to Texas. So wherever the Santa Fe Railroad was, that they had Harvey houses and Harvey girls.
And the conversation between the, so the women who worked, they were young women, right? And they had, like you said, there were some high standards.
Well, they were supposed to be between 17 and 30, but at that time there were no driver's license, Social Security, birth certificates, really. So they could be anywhere from, I don't know, probably 15 to 40. You know, there was really not a way to check that. But he did give them training. They wore uniforms, and they lived in a dormitory with a house mother. And they had hours, and they weren't supposed to date the customers, but, of course, some of them did. They were supposed to chat with customers to take their orders and to say thank you and please and all of that, but not to, they weren't supposed to go out with them.
Do you think...
So they were protected.
This is sort of conjecture, but recently, maybe not so recently at this point, but on the show in the past, we've talked with some women who worked for TWA when the world headquarters were in Kansas City. Would you say that it's sort of a comparable experience in terms of who was attracted to that job and what they found while they were there?
Well, I've never been a stewardess, but my age group, that was a possibility, and it sounded similar in that it would be an adventure because you'd get to travel and your travel expenses would be paid for. But when you really looked into it, you had long hours. But pleasing people and being polite and helpful, that was the same for both.
And meeting lots and lots of travelers and strange, yes.
Oh, yes. Well, and also the Harvey Company was one of the first vendors to sell food to the airplanes, to the commercial airlines.
What an interesting overlap.
Yes.
Were most of the moms and dads, if they found out that their daughter was going to be a Harvey girl, how did they react to that? Because like you said, at the time, they're very limited employment options for young single women.
Well, I think once they knew that the Harvey girl would get her train fare paid to, let's say, Chicago or Kansas City, and there she'd go through a training process, and she'd sign her contract for anywhere from 6 months to 2 years, then they would send her to a site to work, maybe Albuquerque. And during that time, she could come home, like at Christmas time or another holiday, and her train fare was paid for. And then once she finished her 2 years, her train fare was paid for her to go back. She could save that money, and there were tips in addition to her salary. So because she lived in a dormitory-style environment with a house mother, I think they were trusting, and for good reason. If a Harvey girl broke the rules, she was fired.
It was a pretty strict workplace.
Yes.
And you had long hours. Was that more a reference to the airline or to the flight attendants, or were there long hours for the Harvey girls also?
Oh, yes. They had to wake up whenever a train came in. You know, there were different shifts, let's say. And if they didn't have luncheon customers or dinner customers, they were supposed to be polishing the silverware and making sure all the tables were set correctly. And so it was a long day or a long shift, let's say, no matter what the shift was.
What motivated Fred Harvey or the people who worked at the company to start hiring women from minority backgrounds? Was that consistent all the way through? Was that sort of a response to the labor conditions? What happened there?
Well, I think maybe it was a matter of, when you say labor conditions, yes, especially something like maybe the First World War, where that women were just having more jobs outside of the home, and that made a big difference, I think.
We've been talking to Dr. Ray. She's has a presentation coming up. It's Sunday, July 29th at the KC Center Library, and it's at 2 p.m. Are you still with us, Dr. Ray?
Yes, I am.
How much did it become a jumping off job? What did people, when women got quote unquote too old to be a Harvey girl anymore, where did their life go?
Well, that's an interesting question. I think most of them didn't get too old to be a Harvey girl. Oftentimes their boyfriends would come out and say, "You have to come home with me now. You can't keep being a Harvey girl, even if you're having an adventure." So I think a lot of the young women simply married and left being a Harvey girl. The ones that stayed, you could become a house mother, or you could become a hostess where you sat people, or someone who trained the Harvey girls. So there were other places to go within the company. But oftentimes they simply saved money and went to college and became teachers or doctors or lawyers. And other times they sent the money home to their family. And so when they came home, they might have an interest in a farm or some kind of a mercantile business maybe. And then some of them even went on to work for other hotel chains or restaurant chains because they knew the Harvey way, and that meant excellence and politeness.
And a lot of these situations, you know, we're talking about the railroads, and so maybe the Harvey restaurant would be the first one there, and then as more and more people moved there, other opportunities might come up for these women.
That's right, because that was sort of the beginning. But once you have more cars and people flying, well, then there were more hotels, motels, and restaurants, and other businesses.
And so what started out sort of like, I'm imagining maybe I'm, you know, living on a farm, and then I decide to do this, and I go, you know, way out to a place that I've never been before, and then sort of slowly it's like all of those elements of society that I didn't have there before are like following them out there.
Yes, that's right. So, they're becoming more sophisticated, for one thing. You mentioned Kansas City, and I did interview a woman who had gone there to be a teacher, and she would live with her family, of course. This was in the 30s, I think. And when she found out how much she would have to pay for her room and board to live with her family, this family, a strange family, and how much her teacher's salary was, she really wasn't going to be making very much money. So she had a friend who was a Harvey girl at Union Station who said, "Fred Harvey is looking for more women to go out west to be Harvey girls. Why don't we do that?" So they went through a special training, and they both ended up in Albuquerque. And she said when she came home, she was the best-dressed woman in town because she made so much money during those 2 years, she almost didn't want to leave. But she had her teaching degree, so she did come back and teach. But it was a great opportunity.
And it was really one of the first chances for American women to experience some real independence.
Yes, that's right.
And adventure, because you're going very far away.
Yes, you know, adventure could be Chicago if you're from a small town in Indiana.
That's right. I think Chicago is adventure, and I live in Kansas City. That's a pretty big town, but nothing like Chicago.
Right.
Well, Dr. Ray, I'm really grateful that you were able to talk about this. It's, you know, sometimes when people think about work, they just think about, you know, guys hitting hammers or mining or something like that, especially when you talk about the history. But the Harvey girls, really sort of an overlooked part of American history, and I'm glad you've been going around tirelessly telling people about them. So thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, you're welcome, and I hope people will come to the library on July 29th.
That's right. It's the KC Central Library, and it's that's the one downtown. It's at 2 p.m. Sunday, July 29th.
Thank you. Is no charge.
That's right. It's totally free, and they might have snacks. Sometimes they have snacks at that
branch.
Yeah,
I hope so.
Sometimes they even have wine. I mean, I don't know for a 2 o'clock one, but they might.
I don't know.
Well, we'll see you there, and to our listeners, we'll see you there, too. And thank you again so much, Dr. Ray, for joining us today.
You're welcome.
Have Bye. A good one. Bye.
Which side are you on? Which side are you on?
Good evening, and welcome to Remember Our Struggle. I'm Ariana Eckel, a member of IBEW Local 124 and the Greater Kansas City IWW. The Pullman Strike of 1894 was a widespread railroad strike and boycott that severely disrupted rail traffic primarily in the Midwest of the United States in June to July of 1894. In response to the economic depression that began in 1893, the Pullman Palace Car Company, a manufacturer of railroad cars, cut the already low wages of its workers by about 25%, but did not introduce corresponding reductions in rents and other charges at Pullman, its company town near Chicago, where most Pullman workers lived. As a result, many workers and their families faced starvation. When a delegation of workers tried to present their grievances about low wages, poor living conditions, and 16-hour workdays directly to the company's president, George M. Pullman, he refused to meet with them and ordered them fired. The delegation then voted to strike, and Pullman workers walked off the job on May 11, 1894. At the time of the strike, 35% of Pullman's workforce was represented by the American Railway Union, ARU, which had led a successful strike against the Great Northern Railroad Company the year before. When the ARU gathered in Chicago in June for its first annual convention, the Pullman strike was a big issue on the delegates' minds. On June 22nd, the ARU delegates passed a motion to initiate a boycott unless the Pullman Company agreed to submit the dispute to arbitration by June 26th. Crucial to the success of any boycott would be the switchmen, who had joined the ARU in large numbers. The ARU's president, Eugene V. Debs, predicted that, once the switchmen refused to add or remove Pullman cards from any trains, the railroads would fire them and try to replace them with non-union workers, and that in turn would lead to other union members to walk out in solidarity, thus bringing more and more trains to a stop. The scenario played out just as Debs had predicted. On June 27th, 5,000 workers left their jobs, and 15 railroads were tied up. By June 30th, 125,000 workers on 29 railroads had quit work rather than handle Pullman cars. Debs was thrilled with the success of the strike, but he was concerned that people would get out of hand. During the first week of the boycott, he sent some 4,000 telegrams, hundreds each day, urging the ARU locals to stay calm and not to overreact. On June 29th, Debs spoke at a large and peaceful gathering in Blue Island, Illinois, to gather support from fellow railroad workers. After he left, however, groups within the crowd became enraged and set fire to nearby buildings and derailed a locomotive. Unfortunately for the strikers, the locomotive was attached to a U.S. mail train. This greatly upset President Grover Cleveland, as the strike had now prevented the federal government from exercising one of its most important responsibilities. In early July, Attorney General Richard Olney obtained an injunction from Circuit Court Judges Peter S. Grosskopf and William A. Woods, both of whom had strong anti-union sentiments, that prohibited the ARU leaders from, quote, compelling or inducing any employees of the affected railroads to refuse or fail to perform any of their duties. The injunction, which invoked both the Sherman Antitrust Act and the Interstate Commerce Act, also prevented ARU leaders from communicating with their subordinates. Thus, Debs, who had been trying to prevent violence and property damage, could no longer even send telegrams advising against it. A federal injunction having been issued, President Cleveland could now treat the strike and boycott as a federal issue, and he ordered troops into Chicago on July 3rd, despite opposition to the idea by the governor. The strikers reacted with fury to the appearance of the troops. On July 4th, they and their sympathizers overturned rail cars and erected barricades to prevent troops from reaching the yards. On July 6th, some 6,000 rioters destroyed hundreds of rail cars in the South Chicago Panhandle yards. By that time, there were some 6,000 federal and state troops, 3,100 police, and 5,000 deputy marshals in the city, but they still could not contain the strikers. On July 7th, National Guardsmen fired into a crowd, killing between 4 and 30 people and wounding many others. Debs then tried to call off the strike, urging that all workers except those convicted of crimes be rehired without prejudice. The strike dwindled, and trains began to move with increasing frequency until normal schedules had been restored. Federal troops were recalled on July 20th. The Pullman Company, which reopened on August 2nd, agreed to rehire the striking workers on the condition that they sign a pledge never to join a union again. By the time it ended, the ordeal had cost the railroads millions of dollars in lost revenue and in looted and damaged property, and the strikers had lost more than $1 million in wages. Eugene Debs spent a few months in jail for contempt of court, and during this time, he learned about socialism and went on to run for President of the United States multiple times with the Socialist Party of America. Adapted from the Encyclopedia Britannica. Thank you for listening, and have a great evening, fellow workers.
And I would add that Richard Olney, the guy who came up with the idea of attaching the mail cars, was a former railroad attorney. You know, another example of the revolving door of corporations and government. Yeah. And this is Judy Ansel with the calendar. So there's a film screening and discussion of Surveilling Black Lives Matter on Saturday, July 14th at 2 o'clock at All Souls UU Church. And it's sponsored by the Missouri ACLU. This is about how our government is doing intelligence work on the Black Lives Matter movement. Worker Justice Clinic for Victims of Wage Theft. This is Monday, July 16th from 5 to 8 p.m. If someone has not paid you and you would like help from a lawyer in collecting, you can go to this clinic. It's at El Centro at 7th and Minnesota in Kansas City, Kansas. Surge KC, July mass meeting, July 16th, 7 to 8:30 p.m. And if you want to do an introduction to Surge, come at 6:30, and this is at St. Mark's Hope and Peace Church, 3800 Troost. And immigration panel, We the People, All the People, Tuesday, July 24th, 6:30 to 8:30 p.m. at Unity on the Plaza, 707 West 47th Street. That's our calendar. You can find it on our webpage at heartlandlaborforum.org, where you can also find our upcoming shows and our archived shows. And we also are attaching the League of Women Voter Candidate Forums calendar, just issued today. And that first forum will be Thursday, July 12th. That's today, isn't it? Never mind. Yes. The next one is Tuesday, July 17th, 6:30 p.m., County Legislature District 3 and 3 at large at the North Independence Library. The candidates who are going to appear are Paul Rabeck, Lois McDonald, Bryce Stewart, Tony Miller. The candidates who declined are Roberta Gulf and Charlie Franklin. And then Thursday, July 19th from 6:30 p.m., Missouri Representative District 35 is at John Knox Village. And the candidates for that are Carrie Engel, Tom Lovell, Sean Smith. And you can find the rest of this calendar, again, at heartlandlaborforum.org. That's it for tonight's show. Tune in next week. Our show is called A Pension Primer for Young People and Marilyn Brush, Union and Co-op. Thanks to our engineer, Jen Zaman. Listening to the Heartland Labor Forum, a show by and about workers, our workplaces, and our labor movement. We are radio that talks back to the boss, and you can talk back too. Send us your workplace stories, news, and ideas for shows to heartlandlaborformkkfi@gmail.com. Our website, where we archive shows and post our upcoming schedule, is heartlandlaborforum.org. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI or any of the unions involved. Tune in every Thursday evening to the Heartland Labor Forum at 6 o'clock or to our Friday morning rebroadcast at 5 o'clock right here at 90.1 FM KKFI.
Struggle and fight for the common.